Welcome to What I Tell My Patients, a program for oncology nurses focused on the management of gastrointestinal cancers. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. As a follow-up to our recent live symposia at the 2023 Oncology Nursing Society Congress, I met with Dr. Tony Saab from the Mayo Clinic in Phoenix, Arizona, to discuss the recent evolution of new treatments in the management of patients with gastroesophageal and colorectal cancers. To begin, I asked Dr. Saab to provide an overview of how these new agents come into practice.
Clinical trials are essentially how we bring new agents ultimately into the clinic, how we create new standards for patients with cancer. We understand the unmet need across all cancers is the fact that we have great agent, but we're certainly not at the point where we can claim that we're curing all cancers. We're certainly, with discovery, we're getting closer and closer to patients living longer lives, living with their cancers, essentially with the best quality of life possible. And for many patients, even with the most advanced stages, we can claim some cures. So that's important. But these didn't happen except with clinical trials that have been ongoing for the last 40 or 50 years. So what are those clinical trials? Now, clinical trials come in different phases and ultimately get us from the phase one. In fact, you know, there's also a phase zero, then a phase one, phase two, phase three, and even for some agents, phase fours. And then different questions that come back and forth across multiple stages of the cancer. So why do we do this? So first, let's think about the whole discovery process. Think about, over the last 50 plus years, many scientists have been thinking about what is the driver for cancer. And cancer, I'm using the word cancer in general, but of course, you know, the drivers may be different depending on the cancers that we're dealing with. What does it mean to drive? Who's driving? What bad is in the driving seat? And how can we stop cancer in its track? So through a lot of discovery, mostly in the lab, a lot of initial agents, you know, get identified as potentially promising based on the first studies. Now, these ultimately will go through a series of development and identifying the potential safest dose to start with. When we get to humans, then for some agents, there's a phase zero, meaning, you know, we look at the possibility that these agents, especially oral agents, may be affected, say, by food intake, by other elements that may disturb essentially how well it gets through the system. And then we have three major phases for clinical trials. There's a phase one and a phase two and a phase three. And phase one, the first phase, is very important. This is the one that actually establishes the highest, or sometimes it's not the highest, but the most optimal dose to move forward with. What does that mean? That means, you know, can I go up on the dose of the drug safely to the point where it essentially is doing its maximum effect without causing significant toxicities to the patient before we take it to the next phase? For others, like biologics, which more and more of these agents are being developed, so moving from chemotherapies to the biologics, which are more targeted to, say, a protein expressed on the cancer cell or a gene that's driving the cancer cell, those sometimes are developed mostly based on what we call an optimal biologic dose or an optimal immunologic dose, meaning that we want to see the best biologic effect that we think is going to shut down this cancer cell before taking it to the phase two. So phase two is where essentially we start establishing the potential promise of the agent. I mean, we have some idea in phase one, but phase two is the one that gives us the best idea about how well this may perform when we take it to the next phase, and how tolerable is it in a larger patient population that's very focused typically on one disease. Now, without going through variations, there are a number of different ways to look at these. Sometimes it's one disease, one agent. Sometimes it's what we call a basket, meaning, you know, we focus on the target, but we let multiple diseases go into the basket which express a certain protein or a genetic aberration that we go after. But just to make it simple, the phase two is the one that establishes the promise of an agent to move to the next phase. It can be either done as a single arm, meaning just one study, or randomized, meaning we start seeing those signals versus, say, a established standard of care. And then the phase three. And then the phase three is very important, because the phase three is what we call the definitive study. That's the study that's going to tell us whether, this agent outperforms the standards we have today, and then will become the new standard or not. And then the phase three is typically what we call a randomized, meaning patients will enter into the study with a flip of a coin to decide whether they go into what we call the experimental arm or the more standard arm. And that study is usually larger, hundreds, sometimes thousands of patients volunteer to get on those studies. But that's a definitive study that's required by all regulatory agencies that ultimately will establish an agent. Now, let's take an example, an agent called tucatinib that I've had quite a bit of work with. And tucatinib is an oral agent. So it's an oral agent that specifically targets a protein, a gene that drives many cancer cells, whether it's breast, stomach, or colorectal cancers, and others as well. But when it's expressed at high levels, it drives the cancer cell into being more aggressive, into spreading. And so there are ways for us to shut down the signal, to shut down essentially the driving force for this protein or gene aberration, and therefore stop the cancer cell in its growth. So tucatinib is an oral agent. And let's take the example of tucatinib and colorectal cancer. It's an oral agent that essentially tackles the lower part of the protein of the receptor on the cancer cell. So it shuts down the signal that gets transferred into the core of the cancer cell. Now, it turns out that in colon cancer, just doing this is not enough. You have not just to shut down that signal, but you also have to shut down the top element, the receptor that sits outside the cancer, to optimize. So we call this vertical inhibition. You hit top and bottom, and you shut down the signal completely. Now, this agent was first developed in a phase one study, which essentially established the safest dose to use and the optimal biologic dose to use with trastuzumab, and then moved to different phase twos. And focusing on one study, Mountaineer, which is a study with colorectal cancer, combining the two, tucatinib and trastuzumab. So the two were put together, and to try to see if we can get enough responses in patients who failed prior to chemotherapies, and whether the dose that was determined in the phase one study was safe enough to move forward with. Well, it turns out that the response rate was about 40%. Many of these responses were one or two, or even for some 5 years long. So very promising. And the survival was much higher on average than anything we expect. And so the FDA took an application, what we call an accelerated approval, which is unique in the United States for regulatory agencies, which allows essentially entry of very promising agents with biological rationale into the clinic. So this agent made it based on phase two, a phase two study into the clinic. I know it sounds a little confusing, because we said phase three is the definitive study, but the FDA has this special mechanism where it actually allows very promising biologics or immunologics to enter into the clinic based on this accelerated approval pending, so waiting on the phase three study to be completed. So in this case, phase three study is ongoing. Mountaineer 3, that's looking at essentially taking tucatinib and trastuzumab based on the promise of the phase two, added to chemotherapy versus chemotherapy. Now, this is in first line. So this will be the study that will say, that will tell the FDA and will tell us and will tell our patients, you know what? This is indeed very promising. This agent or this combination with tucatinib and trastuzumab will be permanently approved by the FDA. So that's one way, one mechanism. Now, because we're moving into this world of biologics, it's very different from the world of chemotherapy that we've been used to and understanding how development happens. Sometimes phase ones are skipped or are minimized because these agents tend to be less toxic. So we'll take, for example, another agent, zolbetuximab, which essentially is a very interesting agent. So it belongs, rather than to be an oral agent, this one belongs to a family of monoclonal antibodies. What that means, essentially, it's a highly specific immune antibody that specifically recognizes a target on the cancer cell. And when it recognizes that targets, it attaches to it and essentially shuts down the signal. And in this case, it enhances the capacity for the chemotherapy to kill the cancer cell. So that's very interesting. How does that happen? I mean, if you think about it, the cancer cell is, especially when it's dependent on that one biomarker, in this case, it'd be Claudin 18.2, which is essentially a protein that's expressed in malignant gastric cancer cells, so in cancerous stomach and esophagus cells. And it actually makes the cancer cell very resistant to chemotherapy and pushes it to be more aggressive. So you can imagine if you shut it down, you make the cell more vulnerable to the effects of the chemotherapy. And then it makes sense actually to combine chemotherapy with this monoclonal antibody to optimize the effects. And in fact, this underwent again the gradual development from early phase to phase two with promise. And then the phase three, the definitive study just completed the study called Spotlight that essentially looked at adding zolbetuximab to chemotherapy versus placebo plus chemotherapy. Now, it is important to know because we have a lot of these questions. When patients see the word placebo, the first question that comes to mind, does that mean I'm not going to get any treatment? No. The answer is you're still going to get the standard treatment, FOLFOX, the chemotherapy. That's the backbone. But the placebo is essentially for us as investigators and for you as the patient and for all caregivers to understand that we don't really want to know which one of the arms, at least at this stage, you're going to, because there's something called bias. Oftentimes, you know, we tend in our minds to favor one arm versus the other. So the cleanest way to do these studies is to be blinded, not to be able to know whether you're getting, in addition to the standard chemotherapy, the experimental agent or a placebo. So this study essentially did reach its primary endpoint. So again, that's a success story of developing an agent that started in the lab, understanding the target, understanding what drives cancer, into early phase trials, into phase two, then phase three, and showing essentially along the way that this is promising. And now with the phase three, definitively this is an agent for those patients who express Claudin 18.2, improves survival, improves progression-free survival, and seems to be quite well tolerated to justify ultimately its approval. It's on its way to the FDA, so we'll see. Hopefully it will be approved and it will add an option to our patients.
So these are two really great examples of clinical research and how it affects practice. Maybe we can continue the discussion as we sort of broaden out our perspective. Before we start getting into more specifics, one other sort of general conceptual thing that I think was kind of underlying what you were just talking about, which is the issue of, like, you're talking about, for example, colon cancer or rectal cancer, that not all the cancers are the same and that you can break them down into smaller groups within them. And one of the main ways that that's been done in oncology in general has been the use of so-called biomarkers. And you just gave a couple of examples, HER2, which is the target for tucatinib, and Claudin 18.2, which is the target for zolbetuximab. Can you talk a little bit more about how you get biomarkers and then develop agents for that subset?
Yes, absolutely. So I think one of the important, I think what revolutionized a lot of our care today is not just understanding what biomarkers drive, cancer, different subsets of cancers, but how we can identify them very early in the clinic to actually establish the care plan for the patient. So these biomarkers, many of them have been established for many years in different cancers. Then we find about them in others. So say HER2, for example, has been established from the 90s as a target of interest in breast cancer because it's omnipresent, and then ultimately to gastric cancer, and finally into colorectal cancer. But when we look at biomarkers, there are many elements that have to go in place. One, is it a biomarker that is specific to the cancer? Has that been established that this biomarker or this gene that's identified through biomarker assessment is essentially a driver of essentially cancer aggression? And three, is the agent that's being developed, or do we have agents that are being developed that essentially are able to target effectively that biomarker, that abnormal protein expression, or that abnormal gene expression? So with these biomarkers, as we establish their role in driving cancer aggression and having agents that can shut down the activity of these biomarkers, these are the what we call the clinically relevant biomarkers, meaning that those are the biomarkers that, you know, have a clinical relevance, or essentially have utility in terms of making decisions of using certain drugs in clinic versus not. So, for example, in colon cancer, on the subject of colon cancer, 2012, we had only one biomarker. That was KRAS, K-R-A-S. And that's a gene that, if mutated, tells us that we can't use a class of agents called EGFR inhibitors. So circa 2022, well, 2023, since we're in 2023, well, now we have not just KRAS, we have NRAS, so another gene. We have a gene called BRAF. We have HER2 amplifications. We have what we call gene rearrangements in NTRK and RET, which are rare but represent different subgroups. We have essentially MSI high, which essentially, you know, drives the cancer cell to be very hot, very warm, very immune. And that essentially, you know, allows us to use immune therapy in these agents. So now we have all these subgroups. Now they represent 20% of all cancers. Now KRAS in 2012 had only one utility to tell us what not to use. Now we have all these biomarkers that essentially for the most tell us who would benefit from a certain agent. So we moved from negative biomarkers to positive predictive biomarkers, which have a completely different utility and a preferred utility. Now, just to add to this, just moving now into not only that KRAS that just tells us about how bad the cancer does or doesn't respond to EGFR inhibitors, but now we even have agents that target KRAS. So just to give a little history, because it's important to understand how this whole world shifts around us all the time. For the last 40, 50 years, we've always called KRAS an undruggable target, meaning it was impossible to target. And, you know, a lot of labs have worked on it, identified what it does, you know, figured out indirect ways to perhaps shut down. So just to make it simple, you know, we have a pathway. You think about it, it's like the Pony Express. If you want to send a message back in the days, you know, from the east to the west, you had multiple stations where this Pony Express stops at, you know, recharges to get the message into there. That's pretty much what cancer signaling does. So if you have an abnormal biomarker that indicates that that protein drives cancer bad, there are multiple stations along the way to the core of the cancer, to the central command of the cancer cell, that essentially tells it what to do. So many times, you know, when we can't attack the target, so KRAS directly, we try to shut down, you know, let's say MEK or RAF or others downstream to see if we can stop the flow of information. Well, it turns out now that we can actually directly go after KRAS after all these years, 40, 50 years, through drug discovery. And most of the discovery actually happened about 10 years ago. So it's recent in the lab and then moved very quickly into the clinic, went through phase one, phase two, and now is in phase three. And what we've seen is that in 2% of the patients that have a G12C, so KRAS G12C mutation, you can see significant responses, which is actually something that we have never dreamt of over the last many years. And not only that, that tackles 2% of the patients, but that can transform the lives of those 2% of patients. But then it opened the floodgates. Now that we know how to best optimize targeting KRAS G12C, which turns out to be the easiest to do. Now we're moving to 12D and then 12V. 12D is the most common. It's 30% of patients. Trials are underway. There's an agent called MRTX1133 that's underway. There are others as well. So it's been amazing that once you open one door, then you have all these doors that open to you. And once we start applying all these discoveries in the clinic and understanding all these biomarkers that drive cancer, then, you know, we are seeing a revolution in terms of getting these targets very quickly into clinical trials and moving from phase 1 to phase 3 in speeds that we've never seen in the last 30, 40 years.
And I think we should clarify when we talk about these biomarkers, we're, you know, proteins, gene alterations, et cetera, that's in the tumor. So a mutation that's occurring just in the cancer, not throughout the whole body. Yeah. I guess you, the terms are used germline mutation as opposed to somatic, which means just in the tumor. Maybe we can sort of, this is really the one of the most important trends in oncology along with immunotherapy. So maybe we can kind of get into some of the examples. You mentioned so-called BRAF, another alteration that can be seen in cancers. Can you talk a little bit more about what we know about people have BRAF positive or BRAF mutations in their tumors and currently how these people are being treated?
Yeah, so BRAF, you know, BRAF V600E mutation, to be very specific, that's what it's called because there are different types of BRAF. We classify them in colorectal cancer as V600E and non-V600D. The one that's most established is the V600E. And BRAF V600E has been established in melanoma first. And the first experience in melanoma was amazing. I mean, you block it, you just shut down the receptors. Then we found out that in 5 to 8% of patients with colon cancer, you do find these mutations. So the thought is, well, will we apply the same principles? And we just take these inhibitors that worked great in melanoma and try them in colorectal cancer. Well, it turns out it's not the same. When you shut down just BRAF only in colon cancer, the colon cancer cell is a bit more complex in terms of how the different proteins interact together. And so you shut down BRAF, then there is this, what we call feedback loop mechanism, meaning that, you know, another signaling pathway takes over and activates that receptor called EGFR again. And so it bypasses the blockade. And so you really now need to block EGFR and BRAF to get the best responses. Now, it's important, and I want to emphasize that point because oftentimes I think there is confusion about, well, you know, if this target is present in all cancers, why do we need to have different strategies to attack it in different cancers? Well, that's because cancer cells are not the same. A colon cancer cell behaves very differently than a skin, than a melanoma, than a gastric, than others. And so we have to identify the strategies that fit the bill the most. So in colon cancer, BRAF V600E is a very aggressive a genetic alteration, meaning it actually makes the cancer really aggressive in terms of its spread patterns, in terms of you know, how quickly it overtakes the system. And so we have to essentially act very aggressively against it. So one of the first strategies was essentially to really throw a very strong, you know, concoction of chemotherapy to get this under control. Then, again, this is why, you know, all this knowledge starts to percolate. Then when we understood that, you know, one of the ways to target the gene itself, the genetic alteration, is to essentially put this BRAF inhibitor called encorafenib with an agent called cetuximab, an EGFR inhibitor, combine them, and then now we see about 20-25% response rate. So it went from 0 to 20-25%. Now, 20-25% does not seem like a lot, but it's a good start. And it actually ended up, for many patients, slowing down the cancer and even putting it in some form of remission. And so it got approved based on a phase 3 study called the Beacon, and that established a standard regimen for us in the second line. Now, this essentially, as with all agents we study in colon cancer and all other cancers, is when we see the signals very promising in later lines of therapy, meaning after patients fail chemotherapy, then we want to try to hit biology sooner. and that's key, is if something works really well later, we hope that it works even better when we hit the cancer sooner. And so now there's another study called Breakwater, phase 3 study, that has taken this combination into the first line. And maybe we can talk a little bit about the complexities of how to find the target so quickly and so early. But for that purpose, you know, this is looking at what if we just take the biologics and add the chemotherapy, because this, the biologics on their own don't seem to be as active as, say, you know, in other cancers. But with chemotherapy, perhaps we'll see added responses and take them to the first line. The first data suggests a 60 to 70% response. Now, I mean, we jumped from 25% to close to 60, 70%. Although again, waiting for the study to complete and to see whether these hold. But I think that by moving strategically through the last 10 years, from targeting this agent with only one, then two biologics, then adding chemotherapy and moving to the first line, we have moved significantly the needle, or we're about to move significantly the needle for those patients with these mutations.
So I want to have you chat a little bit about another type of targeted therapy that you were referring to before, which is that targets HER2. But just the other thing I want to just bring up as it meant related to BRAF, as you're saying, we're talking about using drugs to treat cancer, in this case of being used in the advanced situation where the disease is spread. And you talked about using those two drugs in people with BRAF mutations in their tumors. And the fact that, you know, a significant number of patients will have the tumors get smaller, the patients feel better, et cetera. What about toxicity? Because a lot of these drugs do have side effects. The normal cells are affected by them. In this situation, when you use the two agents you mentioned, what are the kinds of toxicities that you see and how do you manage them?
Yeah, I think it's very important to understand that although these are not chemotherapy, as you mentioned, Neil, they're not devoid of toxicities. They have, you know, different types of toxicities, whereby with chemotherapy, the toxicities primarily hit the blood counts, but also can cause significant nausea, vomiting, or diarrhea. These agents have their own specific toxicities. So let's take, for example, tucatinib. Tucatinib, you know, is mostly safe. It's a very, what we call very specific. It hits HER2 at a high level of specificity, meaning a very clean hit on HER2. But it does have its toxicities because that little bit of what we call off-target effect can affect the bowels. So you can have diarrhea. You can have a little bit of nausea. All the oral agents can cause fatigue on the long run. So there is some level, even if it's a low-level fatigue, but for many patients, low-level fatigue can be tough. The good news is that a lot of these toxicities can be, in 95%+ of the patients, can be managed with adjusting dosages or giving supportive medicines. So they're really not the toxicities we see with chemotherapy, but they're not absent. With tucatinib, especially when you combine it with trastuzumab, you know, there is, and it's been long established, there is the potential for heart toxicity. Mostly the heart muscle can become weaker. So we monitor those patients very closely with echocardiograms. And in fact, you know, it's incredibly rare, almost unseen, at least in GI cancers, to see a failure of the heart muscle. So we have a lot of ways to actually keep an eye on things, making sure we adjust the dosages. And for most patients, actually, they can go through this journey with, you know, great quality. One way we measure ultimately the potential benefits that we're seeing and the potential effects of the toxicities and how that essentially goes on the patient is measuring the quality of life. So if the quality of life of the patient is maintained or improved, then we know that that balance is reached. And with tucatinib and trastuzumab, we did those quality of life studies, and the patient's quality of life actually is maintained, does not deteriorate, so it does not get worse for those patients who actually respond well. So that tells us that the toxicities are relatively acceptable, manageable, while we actually improve outcomes. With the BRAF inhibitors, that's an interesting one because it's actually intriguing. So when you actually use the BRAF inhibitor on its own. It has, you know, some toxicities like rash, fatigue again, and diarrhea. When you use cetuximab on its own, so the EGFR inhibitor, you actually have significant rash, you have diarrhea and low magnesium. When you combine the two, actually those toxicities drop. So there are lower, less toxicities. This was very intriguing because, you know, in actual practice, the logic says that when you take two agents with overlapping toxicities individually, you add the two, you get way more toxicities and you have to adjust the dosages. Well, it turns out actually you get less. So there was a lot of great work done by the group in Memorial Sloan by the dermato-oncologist, Dr. LaCouture, which essentially showed that the skin actually is a very, is a great surrogate for understanding what's going on with the toxicities overall, since, you know, mostly it's rash. Well, it turns out that a lot of the drivers that induce significant rash, so when you add the two, they counteract each other at the level of the skin and the bowels, and you actually drop down the toxicities. But then at the target, meaning in the cancer cell, the effects are synergistic. So in one way with the cancer cell, a different way in normal cells. A very unique characteristic for those agents shutting down that pathway. But that's, again, that's what we learn as we do these clinical studies and try to understand, you know, surrogate markers of toxicities. But the toxicities primarily with cetuximab and encorafenib remain, you know, what we'd expect, rash, diarrhea, fatigue, and other alterations, but mostly seem to be well tolerated. And again, when we look at the quality of life, the quality of life of the patients is preserved. That's because the cancer is under hold. The toxicities are manageable. So for most of these patients, in fact, you know, their quality of life seems to be improved in that sense.
And we're seeing more and more studies that include measurements of quality of life. And I guess another thing about quality of life is important to think about because, you know, as you were describing, you know, toxicity from the treatment, certainly it can affect quality of life. But the other thing is the anti-tumor effect of the treatment and the fact that symptoms from the cancer may be getting better. And that clearly can have a big effect on quality of life. I'm curious about your thoughts and experiences with that. And the other thing is the issue of dose reduction that you refer to throughout oncology, even with chemotherapy. This is an issue in terms of not just the fact that, you know, this needs to be done, but also the way patients respond when you say, hey, we're going to reduce the dose of your drug and they have a lot of concerns. Any thoughts?
Yeah, definitely passionate about this piece. So the first thought about quality of life. So there was, you know, you can't do those studies anymore, but these were done back in the days with 5-FU, when 5-FU was the only, 5-fluorouracil was the only drug we had. There was a study from, I think, the UK that looked at 5-FU versus best supportive care. And 5-FU was given as a bolus, and that's a tough way to give 5-FU. We don't do it anymore. But it was interesting to see that even when you give 5-FU as a bolus, the quality of life of the patients improves versus best supportive care, despite the toxicities. And that's exactly what you were referring to, Neil, is that the symptoms that the cancer induces, the pain, the fatigue, the weight loss, all these things that drain the patient out actually end up being under control. And the quality of life of the patients actually improves or stays the same, whereby it deteriorates, meaning it goes down. So to clarify, many times we don't see an improvement in the quality of life, but we see maintenance of the quality of life, whereby without treatment, it actually goes down, meaning patients do worse. So I think something to be said about this. The other point is very important. We always had this idea that more is better, and you got to keep on hammering it because that actually makes a difference. Well, it turns out it doesn't. It actually makes things worse for patients. And as we have now more and more agents that we use longitudinally, meaning that the way I describe it to my patients, I'm like, listen, for us now, this is a marathon. This is not a sprint. I got to pace you. We're looking on the long run or years. We're not looking at 2-3 months or 6 months. So I want to make sure that you're able to go through all these options, that every single one of them we know will improve your outcome. So how can we do that best? So the different strategies. And you're right. Patients get anxious because all they hear, if we drop the dose, am I actually going to lose benefit? If we stop the drug, if I take a quote unquote a holiday, am I going to lose benefit? Well, through the last few years, a number of studies tell us that actually less can be more. So say in colorectal cancer, which is pretty much now, our practice, my practice for sure, is if I use FOLFOX or FOLFIRI or FOLFOXIRI, the triple drug regimen for younger patients, even, when I say younger, and then necessarily we're thinking about the 40, 50, but younger is 75 and younger, can still tolerate this. But no one can tolerate this for more than 2 to 3 months. So my discussion with the patient is we're going to hit this hard. 2-3 months, we're going to achieve the best result. And then we're going to talk. We have two options. Either we go on a maintenance strategy. What does that mean? It takes you to the bare minimum. We keep the bevacizumab. We go on an oral pill, capecitabine. But also there's data now, and we published some of that data that suggests that you can actually claim a holiday. If you have a response, you can even say, you know what? I can take a few months off. There are pluses and minuses about this, and that has to be discussion. And study after study continues to confirm that we don't need to go more than 3 to 4 months. With other cancers, for example, we've published data both in cholangiocarcinoma and pancreas cancer, taking gemcitabine nab-paclitaxel, taking gemcitabine cisplatin in cholangio, so nab-paclitaxel in pancreas. And we moved away from the every week to the every other week. The toxicity profile was so much better, and the outcomes were very similar to where we expect them to be. And in fact, about 40 to 50% now of practices use the every other week regimen because it makes a big difference in patients' lives. One more thing about taking pancreas cancer, which is, one of the more aggressive cancers, both with gem nab-paclitaxel and 5-FU nanoliposomal irinotecan, there are studies that were published and looked at what happens to those patients that actually end up having dose reductions because of toxicities, meaning the dose of the chemotherapy is reduced because they've seen toxicities. Well, it turns out that their outcome is at least as good, and in fact, for some, even better, as you apply those dose reductions. So overall, I think the learned knowledge from all this is less can be more for these patients, applying the principles of hit hard, but for a short amount of time, and then go to a maintenance strategies or even a holiday for some patients, select patients. Think about alternative regimens. And most importantly, have a clear discussion with the patient that there's no harm done by reducing the dose, if necessary, of chemotherapy, because that ultimately actually keeps you strong for the next phase, but also does not seem to compromise the outcome. If anything, many of these patients actually do better.
So I want to chat a little bit about gastroesophageal cancer as well, but just to also, again, kind of put in perspective what we're talking about here. One of the issues is when you treat a patient, what is the goal of treatment? And when you have a tumor in general with solid tumors that's localized, often the goal is cure. We may use local therapy, surgery, radiation therapy. We may even use systemic adjuvant therapy to increase the cure rate. So when you think about, risk and benefit of treatment in the cure situation, that's one situation. But what we've been mainly talking about today up to now with these new agents is they usually come into practice in the later line in more advanced disease, where the goal, practically speaking, for most patients is not going to be cure. It might be to extend their survival, but it definitely is to try to palliate whatever symptoms they have, make whatever time they have left as comfortable as possible. Any comments about the kinds of goals you see people taking in the incurable situation? You hear a lot of stories about sort of short-term things. People want to get to their child's college graduation, marriages, et cetera, and how people reorient their goals when they're in this situation.
Yeah, these are always some of the toughest discussions, but necessary discussions with the patients from day one. I think the goal is exactly to be very transparent. I'm not going to cure you. I'm not going to cure this disease, but, when we call chemotherapy or any form of therapy at the more advanced stage, we call it palliative. And we have to, we shy away from the word palliative and, it's been stigmatized, but the reality is it's actually an important aspect of what we do. We palliate symptoms. We make patients, or we hope to make patients feel better for whatever goals they establish. So my discussion from day one with a patient is very, very focused on two elements. One is treatment and two is no treatment. And what do the two means? But before we start this, I usually sit down and say, you know, after we have a discussion about the stage of the cancer and where we're at and the fact that it's incurable, I asked one of the most important questions, the one you said. They said, what are those life events that would drive a decision for you to live longer? Why do I want an extra year or two of life? And, you know, for some, if they're in, and we're seeing a lot of these younger patients, right, with young onset colon cancer and other cancers, you know, the discussion is very different than versus someone who's 80 or 85, and they may have different goals. And so you can't assume that everyone falls under one blanket. So I've had discussion with patients that essentially just told me straight up, hey, doc, you know what? I've had a fantastic life. I've done everything I wanted to do. And you know what? I accept my fate. And I frankly appreciate the fact that you're discussing all these options with me. But I want to go with the option of no treatment and let's see where it goes. And you know, whatever you can do to make me feel comfortable. And we have the other one is like, you know, I have a wedding of a grandchild or a child coming, you know, in 6 months. Now, I can't promise you I'm going to give you 6 months, but I say, oh, okay, we can give it a shot. We're going to try our best. We'll see if we can pull you through that line. So these are drivers, you know. Now, the discussion becomes a little bit different as we're moving to this era of biologics and immunologics. I mean, MSI high and pembrolizumab, we're curing patients in stage four. So that's a completely different discussion. Biologics such as, say, tucatinib and trastuzumab and HER2, we have 4 to 5 patients in that 100-patient study that are now 5+ years out, some of them in complete remission. So it's a completely different world we're living in today. But to your point, regardless of what I think is fantastic or great, that doesn't mean where the patient necessarily thinks it's fantastic or great for them. So we have to adjust, you know, those expectations and have these tough discussions for the sake of the patients. And as you mentioned, I mean, you know, people want to get their, you know, things in order, right? I mean, that makes people feel, you know, better about where they're going with all this. So part of this discussion is, you know, plan for the worst and hope for the best. I mean, as we all do, anytime I'm riding a plane, I'm thinking, okay, is my will updated? Is everything, you know, done correctly? Because then I'm comfortable. You know, who cares what happens? You know, at least, you know, this is not in my control. So plan for the worst, but hope for the best, and let's establish the goals. And that discussion also, Neil, has to happen every single time we need to switch therapy. So if like, or at any point, you know, the patient wishes. But I have this exact same discussion every single time. Your scans are not looking as good. We have this option. But let's have that discussion again. Are your goals the same? And do we need to adjust anything at this point of time? Very important. That's the most important aspect of doing this, especially in the palliative setting.
You know, another thing that I was just sort of flashing on, when we talked in the beginning about clinical trials and, you know, with so many new agents, clinical trials are different than they were 10, 15 years ago when, you know, we're trying one treatment versus another, but we knew neither was really good or very effective. And now we have so many new agents, it brings up the potential advantage of being involved with trials. I'll tell you a story in that. I was just flashing on the fact we did a few videos with patients. And I did a video with a patient who had multiple myeloma who was on a bispecific antibody. And he was doing great. He'd been on it for a year and a half. He'd been put into remission. He had virtually no side effects. And the day that I interviewed him was the day the drug was approved. So he was on it for a year and a half before anybody else could get it and had benefited by it. And, you know, some of the things that you've been talking about in terms of new agents, you talked about these people who got tucatinib and trastuzumab did so well and benefited. So it's not just like the next generation of patients that you're helping. A lot of patients or even phase one trials sometime, as you were saying, when the drug is first used. We did actually ONS webinar on chronic lymphocytic leukemia. You know, BTK inhibitors, as soon as they started using them, they were working. Any thoughts about, you know, that perspective and the fact that patients can actually benefit by being involved with research?
Absolutely. I think that the benefit is definitely more noticeable today than it was, say, 20, 30 years ago. You're absolutely right. And when you look at the phase one studies, and your response rate on phase one studies, just, you know, which essentially, you know, they take a blanket patient X and have them go on a trial. It was less than 5%. Today, it's actually 25 to 30%. Why is that? Well, because, you know, number of things. One is we've become so much better with identifying promising drugs earlier on in the lab before moving them to the clinic. Second of all, we've also learned quite a bit from the past, the past. That's why it's so important to publish negative studies. Negative studies are not really negative. They're positive in the sense that they actually teach us what to avoid for the next one. So it's very important and very important for the patients to understand that there's nothing called negative. It's all positive. It's all moving us in the right direction. I hate the word negative, to be frank with you. And then the third is, as we actually start going into more and more of these targeted approaches, meaning you identify the biomarker, the genetic alteration, whatever, and you have an agent that tackles it, the chances of actually a response goes up significantly, regardless of the phase of development of the agent. And so all these things actually have led to a significant change in the way we look at research in the earliest phases, the phase one. The phase one used to be like, you know, for desperate situations. I don't think so anymore. I think, you know, with the right elements, sometimes a phase one comes before even quote unquote standard chemotherapy or standard agent that gives you 4% response rate, right? I mean, we definitely are in a different world today.
So let's finish out talking about a couple more clinical research issues and swing into gastroesophageal cancer. And you mentioned zolbetuximab, and maybe that would be a good way to sort of talk about research in this field. But before we get to that, just to emphasize another point you made, which is that a lot of times we'll develop a targeted form of therapy where there's a biomarker in one tumor, and then we try it in a different tumor, and we see kind of a similar thing. And in fact, in gastroesophageal cancer, you do see HER2-positive tumors. And in fact, there's a study now, at least one, maybe more, looking at tucatinib, trastuzumab, the same thing you did with colon cancer, now looking at gastroesophageal cancer. So we'll see where that heads. But let's talk about zolbetuximab. It's used in metastatic disease of gastroesophageal cancer. First of all, can you talk a little bit about sort of the anatomy of where you see these cancers, and specifically how zolbetuximab was developed?
Yeah, so gastric and esophageal cancers, you know, are essentially, you know, the swallowing tube and then the stomach. These are the cancers formed along the way. In the United States, the most common location for these types of cancers are actually at the junction between the esophagus, the swallowing tube, and then the stomach. And that junction is the one we see the highest rate of cancers. If you go to Asia, it's more in the stomach and the distal part of stomach. And then in some parts of Asia, you see actually the upper esophagus. They're a little different, you know, behavior overall. So for our purposes, it's mostly around the upper side of the stomach area or the lower part of the esophagus, or that right at that junction is where we're going to see most of those anatomically. And those cancers are driven by, you know, as you mentioned, HER2, but also we know that immune therapy has a role in select, number of patients. You know, without going through details, you know, you have to have a certain score, a histologic score for the expression of a protein that drives the immune response. Some place it at 5%, others at 10%, depending on what study you're looking at. Less than 5%, probably not as much activity, but that's about, you know, a good percent of patients. And other biomarkers coming through, one called FGFR, and now this Claudin 18.2, which is certainly, you know, in the advanced stages. So what is Claudin 18.2? So it's a protein that seems to be expressed mostly on malignant, so cancerous stomach cells or gastroesophagus cancer cells. Now you can see it expressed also in some normal cells in the epithelium. So it seems to be mostly specific to the stomach and to the esophagus. Now, you see it at much higher levels, of course, when these cells transform into cancer. So what happens is that, you know, when these stomach cells, say, normal cells, become cancerous, that claudin 18.2 will flip and become actually exposed on the surface of the cells. So that's one way to think about this receptor that was hiding in normal cells at low levels now actually becoming expressed at the surface of the cells. And when you find it there, you know that it's part of the driving forces of cancer and an area for us to develop agents that target it. Now, when you look at, you know, what percent of cancer cells of the stomach it will express claudin 18.2, it's about a third of the patients. So a third of the patients in North America, at least. And the other thing is, you know, when we think about the need, we look at the overall development of agents in gastric and gastroesophageal cancers, and we see, you know, these immune therapies, you know, becoming prominent in use. So the question is, you know, are we going to overlap? Do we need to think about this as a secondary target or a primary target? Well, it turns out that where PD-L1 status is relevant is only in 17% of patients with claudin-positive tumors. So for more than 80% of claudin-positive tumors, there are no biologic options. So this makes this as a prominent biologic target. And so zolbetuximab is a monoclonal antibodies that specifically target this claudin 18.2. So it actually, as this gets expressed on the surface, it links to it and essentially hugs it. And what it does, it actually induces an immune reaction around it, not only just fixes on it, but also induces these immune reactions that will lead to essentially a milieu that's more favorable to kill the cancer cells with chemotherapy. So the study that took it ultimately to the phase 3 stage looked at adding zolbetuximab to FOLFOX6, which is a standard chemotherapy, versus placebo and FOLFOX6. And the study was powered to show that, you know, we're going to be able to essentially improve survival significantly with adding zolbetuximab to chemotherapy, to FOLFOX. And indeed, the survival was improved significantly at the median. So you can see the separation of the curve. But also, when you actually look at the percent of patients that continue to benefit from it for after 2+ years, there's certainly a significant benefit favoring zolbetuximab. You know, we use this hazard ratio to essentially show a meaningful effect across the lifetime of patients, and it's 0.75, which is actually a favorable hazard ratio for this. Same for, you know, delaying progression of the tumors. And the toxicities were relatively well tolerated. So this essentially, you know, was a very positive study based on a validated target in a very specific cancer. Now, I will say that claudin 18.2 was also found to be expressed in pancreas cancer, and so now there's some work that's being done in pancreas cancer as well in the early stages. But that's about it. I mean, it's pretty specific to this area.
I'm curious, you know, this agent is not approved, so the only way it can be used is in a clinical trial. Have you actually given it to any patients?
We have clinical trials, not this exact agent, but we have other agents that are being developed. And there is actually versions 2.0 and 3.0, meaning taking advantage of how this agent works. And there's CAR T cell being developed around that target. There's also enhancing you know, the ADCC, so the antibody reconjugate effect. So essentially enhancing the immune activity. So although this is not today available, which I suspect it'll be available at some point in the near future, there's a lot of work that's being done to actually try to enhance even further the potential of activity. Since again, we've seen that interesting activity at this level, then the next level with enhancing further the activity of this agent or Furthering the target with, CAR T cell approaches or other immune approaches, will certainly, I hope, takes us even further into a positive direction.
It's interesting though, think about it, like you wake up tomorrow morning, you check your phone and it says zolbetuximab has been approved. And, I'm sure the next time you go to clinic, you're going to have a patient that you might even consider for it. And then you get into the situation where you're going to use a drug that this specific drug you haven't used. And then you go look at the research and the list of side effects and you compare it to the other. And us, in terms of education, we're trying to sort this out too. And sometimes people say things to me and I go, this sounds different. And when I have talked to people who've used zolbetuximab, the one thing that they mentioned that sounds a little different, I'm curious what you've heard when you talk to your colleagues, is the GI effects. And the fact that, as you mentioned, you see this in the normal stomach cells. When you talk to your colleagues, what have you heard about this? It sounds like it's kind of different. Maybe not, but what I've heard is it seems a little bit different than some of the other emetogenic regimens.
So it's a different, and I think it's not just characteristic for this agent, but for this class of agents. So we've had some experience with that class of agents. Per se. So I can tell you firsthand, having worked with a similar agents, at least targeting that pathway, is exactly what you're saying. We're targeting claudin, which is expressed on normal gastric and esophageal cells. So you would expect nausea and vomiting to be one of the most, significant toxicities. And indeed, it enhances. Remember, we're also adding it to chemotherapy in this study. And so, FOLFOX or CAPOX in the GLOW study, those are regimens that do induce significant GI toxicities. And you're enhancing it further with zolbetuximab. So yeah, it can be quite rough on patients. And I think, it ends up being a learning curve, to be frank, like all agents with first in human entry, even at the phase 3 level, right? I mean, we haven't had experience enough with these agents until they actually get into clinic. Many times, even in phase 3s, we're super selecting patients, there are strict criteria, and then it comes to clinic and it's a completely different. I mean, we've seen that with sorafenib, with regorafenib, with so many agents where the learning curve ends up being very, very steep. And so I can tell you, this is something that, at least from the educational standpoint, is going to be very important to disseminate. Is don't expect this to just be easy. I mean, you think about grade 3 and 4 nausea, vomiting. We're talking about really, really rough on the patients. 16%. That's not, insignificant. And add the chemotherapy to that, and it can be quite tough on patients. So I think it's very important to understand that we have to be relatively vigilant and selective as this makes its point of entry into the clinic.
I wonder, too, in terms of the usual approach, when you think about chemotherapy, I think the mechanism is different. That's a central effect in the brain. Here you're talking about something in the stomach. Do the same agents that you use for nausea, vomiting, for chemo, do they work for zolbetuximab?
They do, and adjustments. I mean, yes, it's a different mechanism, but the control center is very similar. I mean, chemotherapy does also injure the surface, and so it adds, insult to injury. And, those patients also can have blockades from their cancers, et cetera. It's a very complicated patient population. But yes, the usual regimens and those adjustments and those delays certainly help quite a bit.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Saab, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for What I Tell My Patients.